So Evarito and I are sitting in a new podcast room, which is a garage filled with tools and
bicycles
and
typewriter parts.
typewriter parts. And it's instead of the Austin Typewriter Inc. podcast room, we're going to start maybe call it the ATI dungeon.
Yeah, exactly. I like that.
I'm looking over to my right and I see a bicycle a la a Remington 5, perhaps.
Yep, absolutely. Sitting on the back of my big dummy.
And you probably can't hear it, but somewhere in the depths of our chambers here, you might hear this hissing sound, and it's Evarito's little blower that he uses.
Yeah, the air compressor. I had the air compressor going a little while ago. I was taking and blowing out a Royal Deluxe that needs a little bit of cat hair removed. So.
Yeah, so... Fred, what do you have over in your side of the country?
Well, I'm coming to you live from my home office here, my little room, which is mostly stuffed with typewriters. I have some wire shelves over here to my right. That let's see, I'm looking at an Olivetti Linnea 98, and a Royal FP, Royal HH, Royal Empress, the newer Underwood 5, the Touchmaster. Got an RC Allen. And a Hermes 8. And then behind me over here, I have, these are all standards, of course. Behind me, I've got the old Underwood, kind of the SX series with the chrome racing stripes. And then right behind me is an Olympia SG1. And then I have a closet full of portables. And that's just this room.
So you've got a treasure trove of beauties over in
sounds
your
like
neck
you've
of the
got
way.
A you're a standard guy. It sounds like you like the production machines. It sounds like.
Well, I like both, but yeah, I do. I'm not. You know, a lot of people seem to really just love the portables, and I would say I'm about 50-50 on that. I love them both.
All right, so we've got a special guest in the house here on Austin Typewriter Inc. podcast. So let's get it underway right here. Welcome to the Austin Typewriter Inc. podcast. We appreciate you taking time out of your busy day to listen to our little gab fest. We're just a group of folks who enjoy the heck out of typewriters and welcome you to our table. Sit back and enjoy the show, and away we go. All right, Austin Typewriter Inc. podcast folks, this is David Gimmiet. I'm here with Evarito in the house. We are hanging out in his, I'm going to call it the ATI dungeon.
There you go.
And we've got a special guest all the way from the other side of the country, Mr. Frederick Durbin. Do you go by Fred or Frederick?
Fred is fine.
All right. Well, Fred, let's just jump right into the deep end of the pool. What's your collection? What are your go-to machines? What do you enjoy?
I most enjoy the typewriter I'm using at the moment. I think that's probably true of a lot of us. I guess if you really pin me to the wall, I think maybe my favorite portable is the old flat top, the Corona standard portable flat top, or sometimes labeled a Sterling, I think. I think that is the perfect blend of look and feel and function. Just a really nice machine. But there are many I like. I love the Royal Model O. I love, I like the Royal KMM. I don't know. It's hard to pick just one, of course.
What's your thought of the Royal P?
Well, if he likes an O, he likes the P a little bit.
I'm also a big fan of the Underwood Champion from the 30s. So, you know, I love the Smith Coronas.
So you've got a pretty good variety of machines that you particularly, you know, jump into.
So do you use any of your machines for writing your work? I know I knew that I found out that you were writing, and I told my wife about some of your books that you had written. And so she downloaded and read a Green Ancient Light.
A Green and Ancient Light, yeah.
Yeah, she loved that book. She was very, very enamored with it. She said in a few times that some of the spaces that you were describing, we've been to in, I think, Italy. So it hit home with her for sure. Yeah, we've been there. Part of her, she's like, Fifi's got a PhD in design construction planning with the, and we went to Italy for six months. And that was one of the stops that really influenced her dissertation. So when she read your book, she was like really just enamored with it, and she was like, I know this place.
So Fred, in the sense that Evita was just telling you about that, that the Fifi has been to a place that you've written about. Tell us a little bit about your writing and your what influences you to each of your books, because you're a published author. What, as a writer, tell us a little bit about that and how you integrate that, your thoughts and your plots, and, you know, just kind of give us an overview of what you do in your process as a writer.
Well, writing is something I've always wanted to do since I was basically an infant. Like, when I discovered what stories and books were, I knew I wanted to do that. So it's, I've never considered not being a writer. Whatever else I do in life, I'm always writing in some way. Now, I know on a typewriter podcast, it sounds a little bit like blasphemy, but I don't actually use typewriters for my fiction writing most of the time. I love typewriters. I use them every day for various things. But for me, it's because of when I came of age as a writer. I came of age right as we were getting word processors. And so I thought that was a wonderful way to work, you know, and that's how I learned to write. So I really like the fluidity of an electronic screen. I like to be able to make tweaks as I'm laying down a first draft. But I definitely love typewriters for correspondence and keeping a daily journal, a typewritten journal. Even writing checks, you know, it makes bill paying a little bit more fun if you can type the check. and lots of correspondence with people as you do yourself. But yes, I've always loved reading, reading stories and books, and so I wanted to write them. And I write mostly in the realm of fantasy fiction, and some for grown-ups and some for children. I've written a lot of stories for Cricket Magazine, which is a wonderful magazine of fiction and poetry for children. And then I have three published novels also, and always working on several.
When you're writing, do you have a process? Like, do you like to sit out on the porch, or do you close your doors in your office and do it? Or do you, you know, what's your environment look like?
I really love to be outdoors. I'm outdoors in every season possible. I think sometimes writers can psych themselves out if they have a really dedicated writing space where you have everything set up and you have this wonderful office and bookcases all around you. I think sometimes that, for me anyway, can feel too serious. And I write the best in casual places, like at a kitchen table or on a patio table or on a park bench. And I really love the Alpha Smart Neo. That is my device for writing rough drafts.
That's an Alpha Smart Neo is just a small screen with a keyboard, right? That's just it's essentially a modern typewriter, right? It digitizes immediately your text.
That's right. It doesn't connect to the internet at all, so you know you have no distraction. It works with whatever computer you have, like it works with the Mac or the IBM, you know, formats. And it's just a portable keyboard that runs on AA batteries, and the batteries last forever. So you can, you know, I think they boast like 300 hours or something of battery life. Yeah, so I just love to go out and, you know, get away from everything for the entire day and just write, and then dump the writing into my computer at the end of the day.
And what's the difference in writing using that device versus, let's say, just using a laptop for you?
I suppose there's not a great deal of difference, except there's no temptation to check email or Facebook.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think that that's probably one of the, there's a couple other tools like that are out there. I think FreeWrite is one or something. There's a couple of different ones. People swear by them because they don't let you do anything other than sit and think and put your text directly into some holding spot to where you can take it back later and then edit it and move it around and change order of sequence of things.
So when you're writing your fantasy fiction, are you the type of writer that makes note cards and puts plots in order, or do you free flow write? Do you have a lot of dialogue? What's your process when you're putting all that together? Any tips?
I'm not a super extensive planner in advance. I have general ideas, but for me, the writing process is really a process of discovery. So I'm figuring out the story pretty much as I go along. To me, that feels like the most natural because that's the way the characters are experiencing the story. Things happen to them. They react to things. They, you know, they make decisions. So I'm kind of usually discovering the story as I go along. Now, I might have some Oh, I heard one writer describe it as like the tent poles that are holding up a giant big top tent, and you can sort of see the next tent pole in the distance that you're going toward. So I kind of know if something major has to happen in the book, and I'm discovering my way toward that. And then when I get to that tent pole, then I look in the distance to the next tent pole and head for that. So I'm definitely more on the side of, they call them pantsers, writing by the seat of your pants, like Stephen King, as opposed to, say, J.K. Rowling, who, you know, plotted all 7 books out before she ever started writing.
Whoa, I didn't know she did that.
Yeah, I kind of tend to be that way myself. I like to seek adventure. I have a lot of dialogue. I become each of the characters. I have a theater background, and so I become each of the characters. And as they interact with each other in my head is when I write their dialogue. And then around that, I'll sprinkle in what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
My problem is I just need to sit down and write.
it is hard to sit down and start. You know, I think it's hard at the novel level, like if you're starting a book, but it's also hard in every individual writing session. It's getting yourself into that chair and making yourself start.
Do you find yourself doodling at times in terms of like, you know, like we had this haiku contest recently here with Austin Typewriter Inc. And like you said, it was a lot of fun. Just I tend to write hundreds of haiku per year simply because I like to have something out on paper or digitally. And so I can write a haiku in 30 seconds. Sometimes it's usually a thought. And then I'll sit there as I'm driving going, oh, my God, I need to write that haiku down. It's so good.
I do write poetry sometimes. Of course, my main thing is fiction, but I think that is helpful. You know, I like to do the street poetry sometimes, like if there's a book event or something, which I guess we might not be having for a while now.
So the street poetry helps kind of loosen you up a little bit and keep your mind going.
I think so. Yeah, I like the haiku idea. I thought that was really fun.
Do you ever bounce ideas off of your wife? Because sometimes people have if they're married or if they have good friends and they have a really good idea for a story or a book, but they're not really sure how to work it out or whether it even sounds interesting. Do you tend to do that with your wife? Do y'all, you know, team up on ideas for your writing?
I do. She's immensely helpful to me. It's not so much about the ideas. I'm the type of writer that I really don't like to talk about what I'm writing until I've written something, like a draft or a chapter or something. So I don't really bounce ideas off her, but as soon as I've written something, then she is enormously helpful. She's my first reader. And in fact, that keeps me writing because I've got this built-in prod living with me. You know, like if I'm messing around with typewriters too much and not writing my next chapter, she'll be tapping her foot and saying, where's the next chapter?
I like that.
That sounds like every typewriter collector that I know's wife who says, or husband on the other side who says, you need to do something with those typewriters.
Exactly.
But so she'll read the first chapter, and then usually she's really supportive at that stage. But if there's some glaring thing wrong with it, like, you know, you forgot a person who is in this room and the person seems to have vanished or something, you know, she'll tell me something like that. She'll read it again over the course of a few days. And then kind of when I'm on the next chapter or a little bit farther ahead in the manuscript, then we'll kind of go back and work on some deeper issues with the earlier material.
And that, I think, is helpful. I think that that's really helpful because I know that even when I doodle with writing, I've had people tell me, well, you know, as you got further into the story, let's say I had 6 main characters, one or 2 of the characters kind of drift off, you know, and you think, well, why were they in the story to begin with if you're not going to utilize them throughout the rest of the story? So it helps you, or at least it helps me to go, you know, I never really thought about that. And I look and I'm in my mind, I list these characteristics out of each of the characters. And I'm like, wow, this other character would actually be better in this scene. And I like to look at it in terms of theater. Like if I'm watching it live, you know, ooh, this person should be in this scene as opposed to this other person, because their interactions would be more interesting.
So I kind of call that leveling it out a lot of times when you do 5 sections or 5 paragraphs or 5 chapters, and you kind of look at, read it again, and you want to level all of these out to the same consistency. I notice that all the time with everything I do. You'll go back to that first one, you'll be like, yeah, I can do a little bit better on that.
It seems like the more time you can let go by between drafts, the better it is for your writing.
So tell me about fantasy fiction. What is the overall theme of fantasy fiction for folks who are not, you know, they read more than they write maybe. What are they going to experience when they're reading a Fred Durbin novel or story?
Well, I heard the writer Peter Straub, who is kind of a fantasy and horror writer, I heard him once say that we read and write fantasy because it's the genre that's most capable of expressing life as it really is, or dealing with life as it really is, which, you know, kind of sounds counterintuitive because isn't fantasy fantasy? But fantasy does get at these core issues of what it is to be a human being, I think. It can deal with pure evil and pure good and you know, gradations and just the human experience of, you know, the adventures we have in life and how there seems to be an invisible component to life, you know, how some things just work out and it seems to suggest there's like a higher power at work, you know. So I do think fantasy is a really good genre for expressing what it is to be human. So you were asking about what someone would experience in my books in particular. I think it's important to point out that I'm really a writer of place or setting. It's almost always a place or setting that sparks my imagination, as with A Green and Ancient Light. You know, I first heard about that garden in Italy, and I thought, wow, that is a great place to set a story. So I start with a place, and then I start to ask myself, who would be in this place? What would they be doing? Things like that. So there's usually some interesting or mysterious setting in a Fred Durbin novel. And then there's often an underground component, because I think one of the things that started me on the path of being a writer was, as a little kid, my parents took me to Mammoth Cave, Kentucky. And I often say that I've been writing about Mammoth Cave ever since, no matter what I'm writing. There's often an underground adventure or a journey underground or something. And the underground may take the form of a deep forest or I have this novel, The Star Shard, which is my one novel for children. And it's set in this gigantic sort of rolling city. It's like a ship, but it's a city and it rolls over the ground. And it has all sorts of corridors and secret rooms and things like that. And then there's always in my books, there's the struggle of between good and evil, and you know, how people deal with the struggles in their lives.
And do you find that each of the characters that are in that, is that a part of you? Is it a part of people that you know that integrate in your life? Are you totally making it up just off the top
of
your head?
So you're asking how he develops those characters, huh?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I try not to use people directly that I know, because, you know, you could get into trouble for that. My main characters are usually some form of me, even if it's a character that's quite different from me. Of course, we write what we know, and we draw on our experiences and we use our perceptions. So I think my main characters are me in one way or another. And then, yeah, certainly I've probably borrowed certain qualities from different people I know. Like, well, for one example is, you know, my wife gets a lot of migraines, and she noticed that when we got together, my main character started having more headaches.
But again, it's what you know, who you know. You don't necessarily think that those elements will drip into your stories, but they do.
Because... Yeah, they definitely weave. Your daily life, you can't ignore your daily life. It's woven into what you are. It's hard to write about what you don't know about, right? It's hard to... So did you visit those places in Italy?
No, I've never been there. I'd love to go.
Oh, okay. I was thinking because it was pretty descriptive, and Fifi was saying that she was convinced that you had been there by the way you were writing, and so she was like, "I know this place." So your writing about place really stuck in her mind for sure.
I'm really happy to hear that it was convincing to someone who'd been there. You know, of course, I wasn't trying to. Accurately represent that garden. Mine is kind of a fictionalized version of the real garden. So I'm sure I changed the layout all around, and even like what statues in particular are there. I was working with a good book. I was seeing pictures of the actual garden. So.
But what's cool about your writing, though, is just like whatever it just said, is that somebody who has actually been to that location is able to visualize their experience, even though you haven't been there. Your words paint that picture.
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of like when I see a painting, for example, somebody who's just a great painter like Evedito, and they can paint this landscape, and they may never even have been there, but they capture this moment. It's the same thing in a book. I mean, you go on this adventure, and you're like, I like writers that can put you almost like you're there with the main characters, and you're like seeing it as it happens, as opposed to somebody who's telling a story and you're like having to imagine it yourself. I want to be there, like you talked about. I want to be there in the moment. That's what makes me more interested in a person's book, especially in the very beginning, in the first five pages. If they can put me there, I'm experiencing it. I know who their characters are. It's like a TV show. If I, in the first 5 minutes of a movie or a show, I am boom right there in
you're
the action.
Either in or out.
I'm there. Yeah. And that makes to me a really good novelist. A storyteller is somebody who can actually, you know, give that person the experience of having have felt and smelled and maybe mm-hmm. tasted those experiences that the writer is trying to convey.
Right, right. I would agree with you. Yeah, that's what grips me about a book. If I really feel I'm there, you know, I learned a secret pretty late in my, you know, or pretty recently in my writing career that I wish I had learned when I was a young writer, but. You know, for me, setting has always been the easiest part. I love to paint a scene, so I was always big on sensory writing, putting the reader in the scene. But what came to me much later is I realized that the story is never really about the story. What we read for, the actual story is about characters experiencing a story. So we as readers want to feel along with a character. We want to know what that character is feeling, how situations are making the character feel. And when I started listening to my characters a lot more, paying attention to what they're actually going through, I think my writing became a lot better. I don't know if it's good, but it's better having realized that.
One of the things, my experience in theater, one of the things we used to do when we would put on a play, for example, is we would have these quiet sessions away from the stage. We, in our characters, we would sit there for 4 hours, and let's say there was 15 characters, even somebody as small as maybe, let's say, a gardener in the show or something, we would all become those characters, and we would talk to each other. And we would talk about our experience, and it was all made up. It was like, it was the story behind the story of where we came from, what we did, what brought us to that scene. Mm-hmm. And then what was cool about that is that because maybe the other character knows the history of that other character that we all made up, of course, then when we actually go and perform that on the stage, you have this greater depth of understanding of where they're coming from. And I've learned that. I learned that back when I was in college. And I try to bring that into this way I write now is I'll make up all these unbelievable scenes in my head just to write this half page.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's a great idea.
And my characters seem to argue a lot. My problem is myself is I need to put them on paper so other people can enjoy them.
That's funny. So you're arguing with yourself.
Yeah. That's why I don't sleep because I'm like, shut up. Stop arguing. When is your favorite time of the day to write? Are you an early morning writer? Do you find that you do it in the evening? Any moment is fine?
I don't really have a particular time. I'm not especially a morning person, so morning is the least likely time for me to be writing. And I am a night owl, so often if I'm working on a chapter or something, I can write late into the night. I pretty much try to start as early in the day as I can and just go for as long as I can. I'm not the type of person that can sit for 4 hours, you know, just writing. I do take a lot of breaks because it's a pretty intense process. But I would say anywhere from afternoon, late morning, afternoon, night, those are all about the same to me. I do need quiet space, so I'm not the type of writer that can write with a TV on or music on. Which, you know, is another reason I like to be outdoors.
Absolutely.
What do you have on your plate right now? Are you finding your quiet time during COVID to be a good time for you to be working on some new projects? Or do you have some that are not yet ready to go?
The situation in the country, of course, has been terrible for so many people. But for me as a writer, that hasn't affected me that much. And in fact, yeah, I probably have had more time at home to focus on writing. What worked out pretty well is we're now working on the third volume of the Cold Hard Type series, you know, of which Richard Pold is the head editor and Andrew McFeeters is my co-editor also. And the three of us are, we were reading the submissions for volume 3 of Cold Hard Type pretty much simultaneous with the lockdown. So for about 2 months there, I was just reading these stories. So that worked out pretty well, actually. And then, yes, I'm also working on some things of my own. I've got a fantasy trilogy that I've been working on for several years now, and it's all written, and now I'm going through and revising it. None of the parts have sold yet. It's a 3-book series. Book one has been worked over many times, so it's with my agent now, and he's shopping it around, and hopefully we'll find the right publisher to connect with. And I'm working on book two now, and then I still want to do a little bit more developmental work on book three. So that's the big project on the horizon right now.
Well, great. It's nice that you're able to, because it is, you know, with a bit of lockdown, that it's not locking down your creative juices. So that's always a good thing. Let's jump back into typewriters a little bit, and because you mentioned names like Richard Polt, everybody in the country, and I kind of, you know, monitor this, but I always kind of see, like, when people are having conversations on their own walls or sharing conversations on the ATC group or the ATI group, you notice that people interact with each other more often than not, you know. Who are your go-tos? Do you have folks in your circle that you lean on? Like, you know, I'm always with Evadito, with John the Shy. We're always having private conversations with each other about different things.
Should I buy this typewriter? Yes or no?
Yeah.
No, don't do it. It's broken.
Who are some of the folks that you look up to or as colleagues that you bounce ideas off of in terms of typewriters?
In terms of typewriters, well, certainly Richard Polt. I remember... I think my first connection with Richard was I bought one of his typewriter pads that he sells, you know, the pads that you put on your typewriter on to keep it from sliding around on the desktop. Yeah, the gray pad. I still use that. I used it so much that the bottom of it got kind of smooth and shiny, so I had to modify it myself. I've wrapped it in a layer of that, the gray kind of rubberized shelf liner that you can get at like Walmart or somewhere. So I've wrapped it in a layer of that, and it's good to go now. But that was my first contact with Richard. And then I think I just, from time to time, would have different questions about mechanical issues or something. And this may have even been before I knew about the maintenance page on Facebook. And then we sort of began to correspond. And then I think when we got a little bit closer was I did this article for Etc. magazine. About writing fiction by typewriter, and I interviewed, I think, 3 different writers and how they use typewriters in their fiction. And that was in it was issue number 120 of Etc. It was the spring 2018 edition. And the writers I interviewed were Linda Aw and Mark Peterson and then Taylor Harbin. But let's see, other writers. I am friends with Mark Peterson. We correspond a lot. I write back and forth with Christopher Oakes. He's a writer out in Washington, the state of Washington.
I just shared a letter with him not long ago, and vice versa.
Yeah, I think I've heard him mention that he corresponds with you. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the dearness downtime that we're having this year with, again, COVID. I put out on that little, I do those little videos from time to time on the Facebook page. And I invited people to said, hey, if you're bored and want to write a letter, because you've got plenty of time on your hands to send me an address and I'll crank one out and they can do the same. And we've exchanged, I think I just got a second letter from Christopher just the other day, which I need to reply to. But mm-hmm. I got like 35, almost 40 different people that I was corresponding with. What's really unique about that is writing letters is that I think that, you know, because I don't even know these people in person. I think I may have run into a few folks over at Herman's last year, but I was so nervous that I didn't get a chance to really get to know people. Because Evarito and I have talked about this, when I meet folks like you or Richard Polt or Herman, it's like, oh my God, I met Elvis. I get so excited. I mean,
that's funny.
Well, it's true of Richard Polt and Herman. I don't think you have to consider me.
No, but I do. I really think that's so cool because I see these people and I get so. I mean, I could meet Tom Hanks and go, okay, well, he's a movie star celebrity, but it's not something that I would be excited about every day. But when I meet other typewriter people who I respect, I get excited. I'm like a little kid in a candy store going, ooh, I got to take a picture with, you know, Frederick or something.
It really is a small community. Yep.
I know what you mean. I feel the same way. It's, yeah, going to Herman's is wonderful.
Yeah, that was great. That's where actually we met you. It was at Herman's, and it was great to be able to put faces and personalities with the little names that we correspond with, you know, daily, or if not, you know, daily a lot of times, because we're like, you know, where can I find so-and-so part, and then somebody will point somebody to a direction and say, oh, you need to go talk to, you know, this person. And so it's really great to do that.
And it was what Herman's was so great about. Oh, is like I said, yeah. I met all these people, and now that they are, you know, they're really part of my daily life, because I now that I have met them in person, even if it was for a few minutes, you know, Evadito had a good sit down with Peter Wheel and several other people, Herman, and you know, we exchanged messages with each other. And like Larry Presnell really impressed me, because I'd had a chance to talk with him, and now I just love when he performs on his guitar. He plays the banjo, and it always brightens my day when he'll play a song that I can remember, because I can't play a fiddle to save my life. But it's just fun to know people that you have actually met in person. It adds a little bit more spice, for at least for me, to the group, you know, to the folks that we correspond with on a daily basis, practically.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, that's the great thing about Herman's, is it really feels like a reunion each time. You know, of course we're excited about the typewriters, but it's just wonderful to see these people.
And everybody is so diverse. I mean, I just find the talent of our community, and I'm talking about the greater Typesphereian community, not just ATI, but just the greater yeah, group.
Absolutely.
There's people with backgrounds that are just unbelievable. And when I go, some of them I'm friends with on their wall, and you know, they're, you know, you take the typewriter component away and you see some of the other skills that they have, like, just, you know, it amazes me what people's interests are and just how deep it runs. I consider you one of those folks. I mean, you have this ability to write, and I'm a writer, but I don't think that my knowledge runs that deep as a writer. But I get excited when I meet somebody who's published books and can sit down and create an entire story just from pure imagination. I mean, that's the most incredible power anybody has, is creating a world from nothing, literally.
Thank you. I mean, I'm always amazed to meet writers myself, and I think there are some great storytellers out there. And there's a quote I love to use with some of my students over the years. I think the writer Paul Darcy Bowles said it, but the quote is, "We are all storytellers sitting around the cave of the world." And I like that, because it tells you what an ancient art storytelling is. Like, it's something we've had since we were primitive people. and we need that as human beings. We just need good stories. And so that's what connects us, I think, with people across cultures and over distance and over time, that we are all fundamentally huddled around the fire in our cave, and we are fascinated by stories.
That's a great conception. Now, I heard the word students there. Tell me about your influence as a teacher.
Okay. Well, for most of my adult life, I was in Japan. I went to Japan right after I graduated from college, and I went over as a volunteer missionary with the Lutheran Church, Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and I taught English conversation there. That was kind of a short-term program. When I finished that program, I started working directly for Niigata University. So most of the teaching I've done was at this university in Niigata, Japan, and I really loved that. I loved doing it, and it was a perfect balance for me as a writer, because, you know, when you're teaching at a college, you're not busy all day every day, so there was time for writing also. And then I did a little after I came back to the States in 2011. Yeah, 2011. I worked a little for a company called Write at Home, which is an online teaching school for it mostly works with homeschool children. So I was reading their manuscripts and giving them feedback and things. And then I like to do writing workshops whenever I can. Like, I like to visit libraries or community groups or schools and give writing workshops, little seminars and things. So that's one of my great joys as a writer, is trying to pass it along, trying to encourage the next generation of writers.
Is that something that you're currently doing too? Are you able to do that with, you know, over the webcam and whatnot, or has that kind of been more quiet these days?
Well, yeah, I haven't done it real not since the pandemic started. And it's not something I do all the time, but, you know, maybe once a year or so I'll get an opportunity to do something like that. I was there for about 22 years. I went over in the fall of 1988, and I came back in 2011. I actually, this is quite a story, but I left about 24 hours before that big disaster that happened in Fukushima, you know, the tsunami that set off the nuclear disaster. So when I left Japan, everything was fine. You know, I took off, life was normal. When I landed on the west coast of the United States, everyone was talking about Japan. It was on all the news shows and TVs, and people were asking me about the earthquake. And I, of course, had no idea what they were talking about. Especially in Tokyo, there are earthquakes all the time, and they're very minor. You know, the ground will shake, and it's so common that we don't even get out of bed. You know, it's like, oh, this isn't a bad one. This is just a little earthquake. So I thought, oh, no, there was no big earthquake. And then I started, you know, listening to the news and realized that this was a pretty major disaster.
Well, and John Monroe lives there in Japan, and he'll post a little, oh, there was a little shake, you know, and it's just normal. But then there's times when he goes, ooh, that was a big one.
Yeah. If things start falling off your shelves, you know, it's a big one. I met John Monroe in person. My wife and I went back to Japan a couple years ago, and I visited John Monroe. And we went to the typewriter shop in Tokyo. It's called Hikari Jimiki. And there is still an active typewriter shop there in the heart of Tokyo. And it was great. It was great to talk to John and to see his collection. And we even did a typewriter exchange. I took over, this is funny, but I took over one of those Remington, what's it called? It's not the Quiet Writer, but it's just before the Quiet Writer. Is it something like the All New or the... Anyway, if you picture a Quiet Writer, you can picture it. For John, that was a rare machine because he never sees those over in Japan. So I took that to him, and I brought back an Olympia SF, a little Splendid 33, and I'd never seen one of those. So it was a nice little international exchange.
So you were there for a long time. What was when did you get started with typewriters? I guess, did I even ask that question?
No, I don't think you did.
When did you get started with typewriters and typewriter collection or influence?
Well, I grew up, you know, in the era when people still used typewriters. Like there were, my parents used typewriters. My mom worked for the school system and had a Royal FP on her desk. And I used, I think it was an IBM Selectric 1, the red IBM Selectric. That was the machine that got me through high school and college. And then right about the time I graduated from college was when we switched to word processors mostly. So then I was writing electronically for years and years and you know, didn't think I would ever look back. I thought, you know, oh, we have a better way of writing now. So I didn't ever expect to go back to typewriters. And then in Christmas 2015, my wife, as a surprise Christmas present, got me this Underwood Standard typewriter. And I was just fascinated with it. I thought, wow, you know, and I loved seeing how it worked and writing with it. And that's pretty much what gave me the bug for typewriters. I started collecting. So I've been collecting since about Christmas of 2015.
And how many do you have in your collection approximately?
I don't know an exact number. It's somewhere between 70 and 80. So it's a, you know, it's a substantial collection. It's not nearly as big as some of the collections of people we know, but it's a good variety.
And do you have like maybe five that are your favorites? Like what models do you find are your more favorite go-tos?
Okay, so here is a quick rundown of some of my favorite typewriters and the reasons I like them so much. I'm sure it's not an inclusive list, but these are a few of what I consider the very best of the best, at least that I'm aware of. First of all, the Optima Elite. I think these are often overlooked typewriters, and that's really a shame that they're overlooked. Their West German Olympia cousins tend to get the limelight, and those are also fine machines. But I think I have personally gotten more enjoyment out of the Optima Elites. They're just a fun typewriter to type on, very satisfying. A snappy feel to them. The LC Smith Standard. Oh, these are hard to beat. One of my personal favorites. The LC Smith always reminds me of those medieval siege engines like a catapult or a trebuchet. You have this long, what feels to me like a very long key lever and long type bar, and I feel like I'm flinging my words out into the darkness and bringing light with poetry and words. So the catapult of the L.C. Smith. The Lettera 22. I don't know if it's pronounced Lettera or Lettera. I think I've heard people say both. I generally say Lettera. I really like the 22. I know there's some controversy over whether the 22 or the 32 is, quote, better, unquote. I like them both, but I prefer the 22. I did not immediately prefer the 22. When I first got one, it almost didn't feel to me like a typewriter. Like, it felt fundamentally different from the way other typewriters feel. And now I've come to really enjoy that. It feels a little bit like a wrestling match, like I'm having a good, satisfying wrestling match with the machine. But I mean that in a positive way, if you can get a positive meaning out of that. It just feels, I think it's just the right amount of resistance to the keys and just a lot of fun. They have to be really clean. I've noticed that about the Lettera 22s. If they have just a little bit of gunk in them, the carriage just flies away from, you know, it won't stay in one place. So sometimes you need to take that bottom off, give it a good deep clean. I really love to use the spray version of carburetor cleaner. I don't know if that's controversial or not, but I've never found it to hurt a machine, and it does leave things clean as a whistle. The Olivetti Lexicon 80, again, it's a near perfect feel to a standard typewriter. And I love the shape of the Lexicon 80. I think John Monroe said it looks like a whale. It looks like some sleek, grand creature of the sea. I love the Lexicon 80. Another of my favorites is the Halda Portable, made in Sweden. Such a super comfortable feel. I think it might be the softest, easiest, most comfortable touch to any typewriter I own. Very, very soft, comfortable keyboard. Takes very little effort to type. I know people that may be arthritic or, you know, have some problems with fingers or joints. I would recommend the Halda Portable as one of the most comfortable typewriters you could use. There's the Underwood Number 5. Very little needs to be said about that. Very satisfying, solid machine. Mine has a super hard platen on it, and I have sent away some of my platens to J.J. Short, and I've been very happy with the results of recovered platens. On my Underwood Number 5, it is so labyrinthine, I've not yet been able to figure out how to get the platen off, and I've asked experts, and they've kind of walked me through it, but even hearing an explanation, I still haven't figured it out, and I'm a little bit afraid of it, to be honest. So I might bring it along to Herman's sometime and see if someone that knows what they're doing can take the platen off for me, and then I'll have it recovered. The Remingtons. I love the early Remington portable typewriters, like the 1, 2, and 3. And this also applies like to the Remington Streamliner and some of the, like the Remington Rand that has the same exposed type bars. I call these the perfect show typewriter. Like if you're doing any kind of public typing at a type-in or a book fair where you're doing some street poetry or something, crowds love to watch you type on a Remington because, you know, you can see that arc of the type slugs coming up and over and striking the ribbon and falling back. It really looks like a steampunk device. Underwood Noiseless Standard. That's another fun one. Big standard noiseless typewriter. Feels to me, you know, with the different mechanical system it uses for inking the paper, it feels to me like a flock of crows. I feel like a bird's wings are beating in there somehow. Just a aesthetically enjoyable typewriter to use. The Hermes 2000. I think that is my favorite of the Hermes line. Of course, the 3000s are great and have their admirers for their butteriness. But the Hermes 2000 for me has a tighter, snappier feel. And yet it's soft at the same time. So if you can combine tightness with softness and snappiness, it's a very satisfying touch, I think. Of course, the Hermes 2000 is the one celebrated by Tom Hanks in his book, what's it called? Uncommon Type, and the story, These Are the Meditations of My Heart. His character in the story claims that these are the best typewriters ever manufactured. So I think they are certainly up there. The Olympia SG-1. feels like you're typing on Gibraltar. It's not just rock solid. It's like the most solid rock you can be sitting on to type. And the same is true for the Adler Universal Standard. Those are two of my favorite typewriters. If you're dealing with something like a postcard or some more stiff type of paper, I always feel like I could crank a roof shingle in through one of these machines and it would handle it. It would allow you to type. I love the 1940s tuxedo striped Smith Coronas. I think these are right among my top favorite typewriters. Just very good feel. Some of the best key tops, I think, for fitting your fingers. Just a beautiful machine, beautiful experience, about as good as it gets. And then also with the Smith Coronas of the 1950s, the 5 series, I like those a whole lot. I think I like them better than the later ones, like the Silent Supers with the fat white keys. Those are nice, don't get me wrong, but I think Smith Corona really reached its pinnacle in the 40s and 50s with the portables. The Royal Model O I love. And, of course, the Underwood Champion from the 30s is one of my favorites. There you run into that problem with the paper bale. I'm always fighting with the, when I first put the paper in and I'm trying to straighten it up, have trouble with the return arm hitting that paper bale that, you got to get things jockeyed around until you can start typing. But that's a fun typewriter to use. The Remington QuietWriter, I always compare that to playing on a trampoline. You just get this feeling of bounce, bounce on the keyboard. Fun machines to use. I mentioned the Corona flat top portable. I have a soft spot in my heart for the LC Smith standard typewriter because that's the one, I actually have the one that belonged to my aunt that she bought when it was new in 1937. I think I got the right year there, 1937. So she bought it as she was graduating from high school and going out into the workforce. And so that's one typewriter that's been in our family ever since it was new. And so that one's really special to me. I, for a number of years, I thought it was lost. I thought she had sold it. And then I finally found it in a storage room where actually I had put it and I'd forgotten that I put it there. This was before I was interested in typewriters. And I had to do some restoration on it. It really needed a deep cleaning, and then I got the new platen from J.J. Short. And it's just amazing to me that something that worked so well in 1937 works just as well today.
So did you do your own work on the machine when you replaced the platen and everything? Did you break out the screwdrivers? Yeah,
I've had to figure that out because there's really no one in my area. There's no one living very close to me that does typewriter repair. So I've had to learn, I really learned a lot from Richard Polt's book, The Typewriter Revolution. I think he lays down the basics really well there. And then it's just a matter of trying things and, having the courage and, balancing courage and good sense because it's easy to mess things up too. but I think just, the more typewriters you have and work with, you learn something from each one. And I definitely would not hang my shingle out as a typewriter repairman. I'm not a technician like Dwayne or Brian Brumfield or someone like that. But I can, I'm pretty good at cleaning them up and dealing with the smaller issues they develop.
Yeah, but 90% of the time that I've experienced, most of the machines work after you clean them, and you really don't have to take and do any adjusting. They after 100 years, they're still pretty good.
Right. Yeah, that's usually, they're just usually dirty is the main number one problem.
Well, let's jump back across the Pacific a little bit because you were in Japan for 2 decades.
David's obsessing on
Japan. When people tell me stories, I learn about cultures and experiences through their stories. That's what I love about doing podcasts and whatnot. When I meet people, was there a good tie-in to typewriters while you were there? Aside from John Monroe's collection and whatnot, did you experience any other places that people had typewriters, or was there any influence, or were you mostly just doing your daily life kind of thing?
Yeah, I didn't know John when I lived in Japan. I came back in 2011, and that was before I started collecting, so I hadn't met him then. What I did notice when we went back to Japan a couple years ago, I just went into a secondhand shop, and there were a couple of manual portable typewriters in there with English keyboards. So I guess there are some in Japan. But I didn't really have a typewriter connection when I lived in Japan.
Okay, well, man, there went my huge, exciting adventure. But let's jump back across now to your part of the world. What state are you in? I forgot to ask.
I'm in western Pennsylvania, about an hour north of Pittsburgh.
What's the experience like? And do you like to go out to local shops or little towns that are nearby you to go antiquing? Do you ever find anything that kind of captures your eye?
Yeah, that's probably where most of my typewriters have come from, has been antique shops. And my wife went to school up in Rochester, New York, so sometimes we have occasion to go up there. So I kind of, and I'm from Illinois, I grew up in central Illinois, and I visit relatives out there a lot. So I kind of hunt a swath from anywhere from Rochester, New York, down, you know, into Pennsylvania, and then westward across Ohio and Indiana and Illinois. So there are a lot of regular shops I try to visit on those trips. And then right around here, this seems to be a pretty rich area for hunting typewriters. I think it's they're certainly not trendy, you know, so you can find typewriters at some really reasonable prices around here. A lot of people don't realize that they're cool, so they're just trying to get rid of their old typewriter.
Here, do you want this thing? I'll give you this rare this machine for $10, and you're like, holy cow, it's a Scholz Glidden.
There was one time in Illinois, I was in an antique shop in this big dim room, and over in the distance, I saw this big squarish looking shape. It was kind of black metal, and it was hand-painted with little flowery designs. And, of course, my heart just about stopped. You know, I thought, am I looking at a Scholz and Glidden? And I got close to it, and it was a bread box. It was a bread tin.
I bet your heart was pounding, and you're like, oh, my God. And then you're like, oh, great.
Yeah, that is funny. I noticed that, too. Like, I've got certain models that I really can spot at, you know, 100 yards, and you can look at it and you can tell, you know, within a half of a year what model when it was made.
Yeah.
So I could imagine.
I was coming back from Houston one time, and I just happened to see an antique place just off the beat path there. So, and I saw a box similar that had colors and flowers, and I thought, and the shape of it, I thought, oh my God, this is like going to be something so cool. So I get it off the shelf, and the guy helps me unbuckle it. Turns out to be a Singer type sewing machine. I was like, oh, great. It was a cool sewing machine, but I didn't want it.
Love it.
Yeah, I know what you mean about spotting them at a distance, because I've been antiquing with people, and I've found typewriters, and it'll be something like a Skywriter or a, you know, a little portable Remington or something, and the person will say, I wouldn't have even recognized that as a typewriter, but you can see this under a desk or on a shelf or something.
So, Fred, you have about 80-ish typewriters, you said. Is there something that you're still, because around that number, you typically kind of find the ones that you really, really like and you prefer. Is there something that you wish you had? And if so, what is it? What is the typewriter you would love to have that you don't currently possess?
I would really love to have a Torpedo. I don't have any form of a Torpedo. I'd like the Bluebird or, you know, just a regular Torpedo. That's one that's still on my hunting radar. And I don't have an old Oliver. I think they're very cool looking, but for a long time I kind of spurned them because I thought, well, they probably don't work that well, and I really like typewriters to use. I like working, you know, I like being able to use them, not just display them. But now I'm kind of to the point of that typewriter is just so iconic that I would really like to have one.
Yeah, they do work, but they're kind of goofy. I've got one on a pedestal in the hallway, and it's got the wide platen on it. And it's a little odd, but there's something about it. It works, and it's just such an iconic piece, like you say. And there's something just kind of beautiful. It's very sculptural. It's just kind of a beautiful object that does work, but it's kind of, they're very beautiful.
I was watching on the Facebook. I saw somebody put a link on there to the Waltons, the TV show. And it was called The Typewriter, so I found it online somewhere, and it was actually, they were using an Oliver. I didn't get the model type, but it was probably a 5 or 9 or something. Mm-hmm. But it was unique in the sense that, you know, here was an entire episode devoted to this typewriter that John Boy was going to write an article to get published in a magazine, but it could not be handwritten. And, you know, when I think typewriter, I'm thinking Royal, you know, Quiet Deluxe or something more in the 50s, 60s. But, you know, John Boy was using an Oliver model.
Well, back then, it's kind of funny. You think of some of the odd machines that we have now that are, you know, the Corona 3 folding machine, the Remington portable 1 and 2 that have the flip-up bars. Those probably at the time, that wasn't odd. Now, the Oliver probably wasn't that odd at the time. It was probably just a tool. And now we look at it, and it's like doesn't fall within the standard of what we would think of as a typewriter, you know. But back then that was the way to go, you know. They were experimenting pretty heavily at that point in time.
Tell us something. Is there anything about yourself that we haven't already explored that you would want to convey to folks? Do you have a dog or a cat?
Yes, we do have one cat. Her name is Fiona.
And does she tend to, like, when you open up your typewriter, does like all these other folks that have pets, the cat comes and starts to suddenly say it's going to lay down right on top of the machine?
Actually, no, she's never done that. She's a little bit of a standoffish cat. It kind of depends on what the weather is doing. If it's rainy or a little bit stormy, then she's right underfoot. But otherwise, she likes to be kind of near, but she's not a lap cat. She doesn't really like to climb on us.
So she wants to be just far enough away to watch you and see what you're doing, but not close enough to be interact. I know that type of cat.
Yeah. Everito has his, which we call our unofficial mascot, Tiger.
Oh, yeah.
And when you hear the doorbell, he... Yep. Then he wants to be all over you. He's pretty hyper, and he got a haircut recently, so he looks very bare.
Yeah. In fact, my youngest wanted a cat, and she's allergic to cats, so we got a dog and named him Tiger as a bonus for her there.
Fred, as we bring this to a close, I want to give you a chance to let people know, where can they find your books? Are they in hard copy? Are they in download form? What are some of the titles that people can look for? And definitely post some of them the ATI Facebook group so that folks can reach out to either buy them online or buy them from you in person.
Especially down now, people are reading a lot more from what I've been seeing lately. So I would definitely post and say, hey. Or let us do it if you don't want to. We'll be glad to. We'll be glad to promote.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. You know, I never take it for granted when somebody reads a book of mine. Every time I hear from someone who's read a book of mine, it's like I'm excited as if I were published for the first time. You know, I love to hear from readers, and I'm really incredibly honored when anyone reads a book of mine. So my titles are, my first novel was called Dragonfly, like the insect Dragonfly. And that's kind of a dark fantasy. It's for grown-ups. That one, I think you can, probably the best way to get it is through Amazon. There is an audio edition of that too, through Audible. My second novel is The Star Shard, and that's a middle grade novel for children. And that, again, Amazon is the best way to get it. It has recently come out in a new paperback edition, so that's a good one. And then the one probably I'm most proud of is my most recent one. It's called A Green and Ancient Light, and it was published by Saga Press, and it's also available through Amazon. You can get it in hardback or paperback, or there's a new audio edition of it, which is really nice. It's by the British actor Matthew Lloyd Davies reads it, and he does a fantastic job. So those are my three published books.
Now, if we wanted to get a hard copy autographed, would you have some available to do so?
I need to reorder them. I mean, I have done that before. If someone contacts me and asks me for a copy, I'm happy to sign it and send it.
No, I know what David's going to be doing now.
Yeah, I'm already logging in to go, okay,
he's got his phone already. He's logging into Amazon.
All right, well, That's Megan. We've covered a lot today in this hour, yeah, and awesome. Fred, it's such a pleasure. Like I said, when I meet people like yourself and some of the names that we know in our group, and it's like meeting Elvis. And I know you may not feel that way, but it is such an honor for us here on Austin Typewriter Inc. podcast to have you as a guest. Evadito, any thoughts?
No, it's great to put a voice and thoughts with the people that we see on the periphery a lot of times. So it's really great to hear your voice and see that we've got another thing that connects us all, which is kind of odd for some people, I guess, for like typewriters connecting us all, but it's kind of a connection between a lot of different people that we all really enjoy.
Well, we thank you for being part of our show today. Yeah, and I hope that everybody out there listening will get online and order some of your books and learn a little bit more about you through your fantasy fiction writing and just, you know, maybe get in contact with you and, you know, share some thoughts through private messenger online and get to know a little bit about each other beyond just the typewriter world.
Yeah, that's right. I'm so grateful to you guys for doing these podcasts. I really, it is fascinating. Some of the people you've talked to and just hearing you guys talk, learn a lot.
All right. Any final thoughts, Fred?
Hour has really flown by. I wondered if we would have things to talk about for an hour, but we've managed to do it.
I told you that it would be fun. We like to make it interesting here. Well, I want to wrap it up here. Then I'm David Gimiet here with Evadito in the house. And we have the great pleasure of talking with Frederick Durbin over in Pennsylvania, writer, Typesphereian, adventurer. And so thank you for being part of our podcast today.
Thank you, guys.
All right, you're listening to Austin Typewriter Inc. podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Austin Typewriter Inc. podcast. For more information about our group, please find us online at austintypewriterinc.com, or you can also visit us on Facebook and Instagram. Join us next time for another episode of Austin Typewriter Inc. May your type slugs always be clean.